This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Answering your astronomical questions in this month's Ask an Astronomer is Dr. Ian MacDonald. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Libby.
And our first question is from the great old Mac, who asks, on our next visit to the Jupiter system, should we send a probe to Io to look for life signs based on sulphur? How would it look for life, and what research has been done on sulphur-based life?
Well, great old Mac, this is great young Mac, and I've got to ask, have you got a spare £1 billion? Do you fancy sending a probe to Io? Well, go for it. But it probably won't phone home to say it's found life. Typically, searches for life will look for chemical reactions that are out of equilibrium, like an unexpected balance of ozone and methane in the atmosphere. But for sulphur-based life, it's difficult to know where to start. For Io, another problem is that it has no meaningful atmosphere. This means that it has no gas, no liquid on the surface, and, as a little experimentation will show, it's a lot easier to make chemical reactions work effectively in a liquid than in a solid. So any sign of life in Io would have to be found underground. Now finally, and rather fundamentally, it's really quite difficult to imagine what kind of sulphur-based life would work. Carbon's quite remarkable in its ability to form different kinds of chemical bonds, and carbon-based chemistry also interacts very well with water, which is a particularly good solvent. Now, with a more limited range of chemical reactions available to it, producing sulphur-based life should be a lot more difficult than producing carbon-based life. So, I wouldn't advocate sending a probe to Io to look for life. Europa, maybe, or even Ganymede, would be much better targets.
Why do you think they'd be much better targets?
Well, Europa's got a subsurface ocean. It's covered by an icy crust, but underneath that crust, the water's actually liquid, and we think it's probably quite chemically rich. The interior's tidally heated by Jupiter, and we think that in there might be some thermal springs or underwater volcanoes that might provide conditions similar to those found in the early Earth, where we think that life arose. Ganymede, it's a bit further out from Jupiter, but we think it's still got a subsurface ocean. It's smaller, it's thinner, and it's a lot further from the surface, but theoretically we could still look for life on there.
Okay, thank you. And carrying on with the Jupiter theme, John Morell asks, Jupiter appears to have been hit by another asteroid. Are asteroids more likely to hit the visible side of Jupiter or the side facing away from the Sun?
Well, in this case, John's referring to quite a small asteroid, probably only a few metres across, which hit Jupiter in September. Old listeners among you may remember the impact of Shoemaker-Levy 9 into Jupiter in 1994. In both cases, the impact happened on the edge of the planet as we see it. But is this what normally happens? Oh well, let's smash some stuff into Jupiter and see what happens. Well, first up, we take a comet. Now, comets typically have very elongated orbits, and they'll pass through planets' orbits at nearly right angles, once on the way in, once on the way out. And if a comet hits Jupiter on the way in, it'll hit its dark side, which faces away from us. If it hits Jupiter on the way out, it'll hit the day side of Jupiter, where we can see it. Now, ignoring the small fraction that hit the Sun or hit other planets, the front side of Jupiter is as likely to take a battering from a comet as a back side, so it kind of evens out. But comets only impact Jupiter fairly rarely. Shoemaker-Levy 9 was an exception. It's much more common for asteroids to hit Jupiter. Now, asteroids tend to go around the Sun in the same direction as Jupiter, and roughly at the same speed. But they'll be going slightly faster or slightly slower than Jupiter when they share its orbit. Now, if an asteroid is travelling faster than Jupiter, it'll catch it up and hit its trailing side, and that's its western edge, or right edge if you're in the northern hemisphere. Now, if the asteroid's travelling a bit slower than Jupiter, it'll hit the leading side of Jupiter. That's the eastern side, or the left-hand edge if you're in the northern hemisphere. Most asteroids start out closer to the Sun than Jupiter, and that means that we'll be travelling more slowly than Jupiter if they cross its orbit. So typically, the leading side gets hit more often. So while the side of Jupiter that faces us gets as many hits as the back side, it's the edges of Jupiter, as we see them, that bear the scars of its battles most. In particular, its left edge, that's if you're in the northern hemisphere, its right edge if you're in the southern hemisphere, is the one that gets whacked the most. And this is also true of Earth. You're more likely to get hit by a meteor at 6 p.m. than any other time of day. While we don't know of any that are going to hit us soon, there'll be a close approach by a small asteroid on February the 15th, and that should be visible with binoculars if you know where to look. We'll put the links in the show notes.
Thank you for that, Ian. Our final question comes from Cass Lieber, who says, I've been seeing snippets here and there about Delta Scorpii increasing brightness in the past few years. Any chance of a nice explanation on what we know and don't know about this star?
Delta Scorpii is one of the few stars that you can see change in brightness with your naked eye. It's a binary system, with two very hot blue stars. Each of the stars is several times larger than the Sun, and they orbit each other every 11 years. Now, the orbit is very eccentric. The two stars orbit each other in nearly a figure-of-eight pattern. And the close passage of the two stars means that hot plasma is actually ripped off the slightly larger star of the pair to form a disk of gas around it. And it's this disk that brightens every 11 years or so as the two stars pirouette around each other, and it increases the total brightness of Delta Scorpii by about 50%. Now, that sounds like quite a lot, but it's not really enough to make a noticeable difference unless you're specifically looking out for it. But Delta Scorpii isn't the only variable star visible to the naked eye. The variable star that's probably been known the longest is Algol, or Beta Persei. Now, Algol comes from the Arabic meaning head of the ghoul, Algol, and it's loosely translated as the devil's star. It's often been shown throughout history as the eye in the Gorgon Medusa's head, which Perseus wields in his never-ending celestial battle with the sea monster Cetus. It gets its demonic name partly from its red colour and partly from its variability. Now, we know that Algol is also a binary star, and when one star passes in front of the other, as it does every 2.87 days, it dips in brightness by a factor of about 3 for a few hours. And if you compare its brightness to that of the surrounding stars, you can see Medusa's eye wink very slowly over the course of a night. Now, let me introduce you to another pair of variable stars, Betelgeuse and Myra. These are both red giant stars, and their atmospheres pulsate, causing them to change brightness very slowly over many months. Betelgeuse, being a massive star, has rather chaotic pulsations, and it can vary in brightness by up to a factor of 2 over the course of a season. You can try comparing it to nearby stars Rigel and Aldebaran. That's Beta Orionis and Alpha Tauri, if you want to see how bright it is at the moment. Then try again in a few months. And while you may have heard of Betelgeuse, you may not have heard of Myra. Myra, otherwise known as Omicron Ceti, was discovered to be variable in the 17th century and takes its name from the Latin meaning wonderful. And it really is a wonderful star. Every 11 months, Myra changes between being an obscure 10th magnitude star which you can only see with a telescope, to being a magnificent 3rd or even 2nd magnitude star, the brightest in that part of the sky. That's a factor of nearly 1,000 different in brightness. Now, Myra is currently returning to a minimum, which is expected in early April when it's behind the Sun. But it'll return to its full wonderful glory in late July in the early morning sky. See if you can spot it then.
Thank you to the great old Mac, John Morrell, and Cass Lieber for your questions. And if you'd like to have your questions answered in Ask an Astronomer, please get in touch via the website.